and draughty, full of drifting smoke, its stone walls spotted by huge patches of pale lichen. A peat fire burned low in a hearth blackened by the hotter blazes of years past. A massive table of carved stone filled the chamber, as it had for centuries.
"There was where I sat the last time I was here," he remembered. "Rob was at the head of the table, with the great John to his right, and Roose Bolden on his left. The Glovers sat next to Helm and Tallheart. Carstock and his sons were across from them."
24 Ironborn sat drinking at the table. A few looked at him with dull, flat eyes when he entered. The rest ignored him. All the men were strangers to him. Several wore cloaks fastened by brooches in the shape of silver codfish. The cods were not well regarded in the Iron Islands. The men were said to be thieves and cowards, the women wantons who bedded with their own fathers and brothers. It did not surprise him that his uncle had chosen to leave these men behind when the Iron Fleet went home.
"This will make my task that much easier."
"Ralph Kenning is dead," he said. "Who commands here?"
The drinkers stared at him blankly. One laughed, another spat. Finally, one of the cods said,
"Who asks?"
"Lord Balin's son." "Reek, my name is Reek. It rhymes with cheek. I am here at the command of Ramsay Bolton, Lord of the Hornwood, and heir to the Dreadfort, who captured me at Winterfell. His host is north of you, his father's to the south. But Lord Ramsay is prepared to be merciful if you yield Moat Cailin to him before the sun goes down."
He drew out the letter they'd given him and tossed it on the table before the drinkers. One of them picked it up and turned it over in his hands, picking at the pink wax that sealed it. After a moment he said,
"Parchment, what good is that? It's cheese we need, and meat."
"Steel, you mean?" said the man beside him, a greybeard, whose left arm ended in the stump.
"Swords, axes, aye, and bows, 100 more bows, and men to loose the arrows."
"Ironborn, do not surrender," said a third voice.
"Tell that to my father. Lord Balin bent the knee when Robert broke his wall. Elsewise he would have died, as you will, if you do not yield."
He gestured at the parchment.
"Break the seal. Read the words. That is a safe conduct, written in Lord Ramsay's own hand. Give up your swords and come with me, and his lordship will feed you and give you leave to march unmolested to the stony shore and find a ship for home. Elsewise, you die."
"Is that a threat?"
One of the cods pushed to his feet. A big man, but pop-eyed and wide of mouth, with dead white flesh. He looked as if his father had sired him on a fish, but he still wore a longsword.
"Dagon Cod yields to no man."
"No, please, you have to listen."
The thought of what Ramsay would do to him if he crept back to camp without the garrison's surrender was almost enough to make him piss his breeches.
"Reek, reek, it rhymes with leak. Is that your answer?"
The words rang feebly in his ears.
"Does this codfish speak for all of you?"
The guard who had met him at the door seemed less certain.
"Victorian commanded us to hold."
He did.
"I heard him with my own ears. Hold here till I return," he told Kenning.
"Aye," said the one-armed man, "that's what he said. The king's moot called, but he swore that he'd be back, with a driftwood crown upon his head and 1,000 men behind him."
"My uncle is never coming back," Reek told them. "The Kingswood crowned his brother, Euron, and the Crow's Eye has other wars to fight."
"You think my uncle values you?"
"He doesn't. You are the ones he left behind to die. He scraped you off the same way he scrapes mud off his boots when he wades ashore."
Those words struck home. He could see it in their eyes, in the way they looked at one another, or frowned above their cups. They all feared they'd been abandoned, but it took me to turn fear into certainty. These were not the kin of famous captains, nor the blood of the great houses of the Iron Islands. These were the sons of thralls and salt wives.
"If we yield, we walk away," said the one-armed man. "Is that what it says on this here writing?"
He nudged the roll of parchment, its wax seal still unbroken.
"Read it for yourself," he answered,
though he was almost certain that none of them could read.
"Lord Ramsay treats his captives honourably, so long as they keep faith with him.
He's only taken toes and fingers and that other thing when he might have had my tongue or peeled the skin off my legs from heel to thigh. Yield up your swords to him and you will live."
"Liar!"
Dagon Cud drew his longsword.
"You're the one they call Turncloak. Why should we believe your promises?"
"He is drunk," Reek realized. "The ale is speaking.
Believe what you want. I have brought Lord Ramsay's message. Now I must return to him. We'll sup on wild boar and neeps, washed down with strong red wine. Those who come with me will be welcome at the feast. The rest of you will die within a day. The Lord of the Dreadfort will bring his knights up the causeway, whilst his son leads his own men down on you from the north. No quarter will be granted. The ones that die fighting will be the lucky ones. Those who live will be given to the bug devils."
"Enough," snarled Dagon Cud. "You think you can frighten Ironborn with words? Begone, run back to your master before I open your belly, pull your entrails out and make you eat them." He might have said more, but suddenly his eyes gaped wide. A throwing axe sprouted from the centre of his forehead with a solid thunk. Cud's sword fell from his fingers. He jerked like a fish on a hook, then crashed, face first, onto the table. It was the one-armed man who flung the axe. As he rose to his feet, he had another in his hand.
"Who else wants to die?"
he asked the other drinker.
"Speak up! I'll see you do!"
Thin red streams were spreading out across the stone from the pool of blood where Dagon Cud's head had come to rest.
"Me? I mean to live. And that don't mean staying here to rot."
One man took a swallow of ale. Another turned his cup over to wash away a finger of blood before it reached the place where he was seated. No one spoke. When the one-armed man slid the throwing axe back through his belt, Reek knew he had won. He almost felt a man again.
"Lord Ramsay will be pleased with me."
He pulled down the kraken banner with his own two hands, fumbling some because of his missing fingers, but thankful for the fingers that Lord Ramsay had allowed him to keep. It took the better part of the afternoon before the Ironborn were ready to depart. There were more of them than he would have guessed. 47 in the Gatehouse Tower and another 18 in the Drunkard's Tower. Two of those were so close to dead that there was no hope for them. Another 5 too weak to walk. That still left 58 who were fit enough to fight. Weak as they would have taken 3 times their own number with them if Lord Ramsay had stormed the ruins.
"He did well to send me," Reek told himself, as he climbed back onto his stut to lead the ragged column back across the buggy ground to where the Northmen were encamped. "Leave your weapons here," he told the prisoners. "Swords, bows, daggers, armed men will be slain on sight."
It took them thrice as long to cover the distance as it had taken Reek alone. Crude litters had been patched together for 4 of the men who could not walk. The 5th was carried by his son upon his back. It made for slow going, and all the Ironborn were well aware of how exposed they were. well within bowshot of the bug devils and their poisoned arrows.
"If I die, I die."
Reek only prayed the archer knew his business, so death would be quick and clean.
"A man's death, not the end Ralph Kenning suffered."
The one-armed man walked at the head of the procession, limping heavily. His name, he said, was Adrak Humble, and he had a rock wife and three salt wives back on Great Wick.
"Three of the four had big bellies when we sailed," he boasted, "and Humble's run to twins. First thing I'll need to do when I get back is count up my new sons. Might be I'll even name one after you, my lord."
"Aye, name him Reek," he thought, "and when he's bad, he can cut his toes off and give him rats to eat." He turned his head and spat, and wondered if Ralph Kenning hadn't been the lucky one. A light rain had begun to piss down out of the slate-grey sky by the time Lord Ramsay's camp appeared in front of them. A sentry watched them pass in silence. The air was full of drifting smoke from the cook fires drowning in the rain. A column of riders came wheeling up behind them, led by a lordling with a horse head on his shield. One of Lord Ryswell's sons, Reek knew. Roger, or maybe Rickard. He could not tell the two of them apart.
"Is this all of them?" the rider asked, from atop a chestnut stallion.
"All that weren't dead, my lord."
"I thought there would be more.
We came at them three times, and three times they threw us back." "We are ironborn," he thought, and with a sudden flash of pride, and for half a heartbeat, he was a prince again, Lord Balin's son, the blood of Pike. Even thinking was dangerous, though. He had to remember his name.
"Reek, my name is Reek, it rhymes with weak."
They were just outside the camp when the baying of a pack of hounds told of Lord Ramsay's approach. Horsebane was with him, along with half a dozen of his favourites, Skinner and Sour Allen and Damon Dance for Me, and the Walders, big and little too. The dogs formed around them, snapping and snarling at the strangers.
"The bastards' girls," Reek thought, before he remembered that one must never, never, never use that word in Ramsay's presence.
Reek swung down from saddle and took a knee.
"My lord, Moat Cailin is yours. Here are its last defenders."
"So few? I had hoped for more. They were such stubborn foes."
Lord Ramsay's pale eyes shone. "You must be starved, Damon, Allen, see to them. Wine and ale and all the food that they can eat. Skinner, show their wounded to our maesters."
"Aye, my lord."
A few of the ironborn muttered thanks before they shambled off toward the cook fires in the centre of the camp. One of the cods even tried to kiss Lord Ramsay's ring, but the hounds drove him back before he could get close, and Allison took a chunk of his ear. Even as the blood streamed down his neck, the man bobbed and bowed and praised his lordship's mercy. When the last one were gone, Ramsay Bolton turned his smile on Reek. He clasped him by the back of the head, pulled his face close, kissed him on his cheek, and whispered,
"My old friend Reek, did they really take you for their prince? Oh, what bloody fools, these iron men. The guards are laughing."
"All they want is to go home, my lord."
"And what do you want, my sweet Reek?"
Ramsay murmured, as softly as a lover. His breath smelled of mulled wine and cloves, so sweet.
"Such valiant service deserves a reward. I cannot give you back your fingers or your toes, but surely there is something you would have of me. Shall I free you instead? Release you for my service? Do you want to go with them, return to your bleak isles in the cold grey sea, be a prince again? Or would you sooner stay my leal serving men?"
A cold knife scraped along his spine.
"Be careful," he told himself. "Be very, very careful."
He did not like his lordship's smile, the way his eyes were shining, the spittle glistening at the corner of his mouth. He had seen such signs before.
"You are no prince, you're Reek, Just reek, it rhymes with freak. Give him the answer that he wants. My lord, he said, my place is here with you. I'm your reek. I only want to serve you. All I ask, a skin of wine that would be reward enough for me. Red wine, the strongest that ye have. All the wine a man can drink. Lord Ramsay laughed.
You're not a man, reek. You're just my creature. You'll have your wine there. Walder, see to it, and fear not. I won't return you to the dungeons. You have my word as a Bolton. We'll make a dog of you instead. Meat every day, and I'll even leave you teeth enough to eat it. You can sleep beside my girls. Ben, do you have a collar for him?
I'll have one made, my lord, said old Ben Bones.
The old man did better than that. That night, besides the collar, there was a ragged blanket, too, and half a chicken. Reek had to fight the dogs for the meat, but it was the best meal that he'd had since Winterfell. And the wine. The wine was dark and sour, but strong. Squatting amongst the hounds, Reek drank until his head swam, retched, wiped his mouth, and drank some more. Afterwards he lay back and closed his eyes. When he woke, a dog was licking vomit from his beard, and dark clouds were scuttling across the face of a sickle moon. Somewhere in the night, men were screaming. He shoved the dog aside, rolled over, and went back to sleep. The next morning, Lord Ramsay dispatched three riders down the causeway to take word to his lord father that the way was clear. The flayed man of House Bolton was hoisted above the gatehouse tower, where Reek had hauled down the golden kraken of pike. Along the rotting plank road, wooden stakes were driven deep into the boggy ground. There the corpses festered, red and dripping. 63, he knew. There are 63 of them. One was short half an arm, another had a parchment shoved between his teeth, its wax seal still unbroken. 3 days later, the vanguard of Roose Bolton's host threaded its way through the ruins and past the row of grisly sentinels. 400 mounted Freys clad in blue and grey, their spear points glittering whenever the sun broke through the clouds. 2 of old Lord Walder's sons led the van. One was brawny, with a massive jut of jaw and arms thick with muscle. The other had hungry eyes, close set above a pointed nose, a thin brown beard that did not quite conceal the weak chin beneath it, a bald head. Hustine and Anus, he remembered them from before he knew his name. Hustine was a bull, slow to anger but implacable once roused, and by repute the fiercest fighter of Lord Walder's get. Anus was older, crueler, and more clever. A commander, not a swordsman. Both were seasoned soldiers. The Northmen followed hard behind the van, their tattered banners streaming in the wind. Reek watched them pass. Most were afoot, and there were so few of them. He remembered the great host that marched south with young Wolf beneath the dire wolf of Winterfell. 20,000 swords and spears had gone off to war with Rob, or near enough to make no matter, but only 2 in 10 were coming back, and most of those were Dreadfort men. Back where the press was thickest, at the centre of the column, rode a man armoured in dark grey plate over a quilted tunic of blood-red leather. His rundles were wrought in the shape of human heads, with open mouths that shrieked in agony. From his shoulder streamed a pink woolen cloak embroidered with droplets of blood. Long streamers of red silk fluttered from the top of his closed helm.
No Cranach man will slay Roose Bolton with a poisoned arrow, Reek thought, when he first saw him.
An enclosed wagon groaned along behind him, drawn by 6 heavy draft horses and defended by crossbowmen front and rear. Curtains of dark blue velvet concealed the wagon's occupants from watching eyes.
Farther back came the baggage train, lumbering wains laden with provisions and loot taken in the war, and carts crowded with wounded men and cripples. And at the rear, more frays. At least 1,000, maybe more. Bowmen, spearmen, peasants armed with scythes and sharpened sticks, free riders and mounted archers, and another 100 knights to stiffen them. Collared and chained, and back in rags again, Reek followed with the other dogs at Lord Ramsay's heels when his lordship strode forth to greet his father. When the rider in the dark armour removed his helm, however, the face beneath was not one that Reek knew. Ramsay's smile curled at the sight, and anger flashed across his face. "What is this, some mockery?"
"Just caution," whispered Roose Bolton, as he emerged from behind the curtains of the enclosed wagon. The Lord of the Dreadfort did not have a strong likeness to his bastard son. His face was clean-shaven, smooth-skinned, ordinary, not handsome, but not quite plain. Though Roos had been in battles, he bore no scars. Though well past 40, he was as yet unwrinkled, with scarce a line to tell of the passage of time. His lips were so thin that when he pressed them together, they seemed to vanish altogether. There was an agelessness about him, a stillness. On Roos Bolton's face, rage and joy looked much the same. All he and Ramsay had in common were their eyes.
"His eyes are ice," Reek wondered if Roos Bolton ever cried. "If so, do the tears feel cold upon his cheeks?"
Once a boy named Theon Greyjoy had enjoyed tweaking Bolton as they sat at council with Robb Stark, mocking his soft voice and making japes about leeches.
"He must have been mad. This is no man to jape with."
You had only to look at Bolton to know that he had more cruelty in his pinky toe than all the frays combined. "Father," Lord Ramsay knelt before his sire. Lord Roos studied him for a moment. "You may rise." He turned to help two young women down from inside the wagon. The first was short and very fat, with a round red face and three chins wobbling beneath a sable hood.
"My new wife," Roos Bolton said. "Lady Wilder, this is my natural son. Kiss your stepmother's hand, Ramsay."
He did.
"And I'm sure you will recall the Lady Arya, your betrothed."
The girl was slim and taller than he remembered, but that was only to be expected.
"Girls grow fast at that age."
Her dress was grey wool, bordered with white satin. Over it she wore an ermine cloak, clasped with a silver wolf's head. Dark brown hair fell halfway down her back, and her eyes.
"That is not Lord Eddard's daughter."
Arya had her father's eyes, the grey eyes of the Starks. A girl her age might let her hair grow long, add inches to her height, see her chest fill out, but she could not change the colour of her eyes.
"That's Sansa's little friend, the Stuart's girl, Jane. That was her name, Jane Poole."
"Lord Ramsay,"
the girl dipped down before him. That was wrong as well.
"The real Arya Stark would have spat into his face. I pray that I will make you a good wife and give you strong sons to follow after you."
"That you will," promised Ramsay, "and soon."
Tyrion. They had warned him to dress warmly. Tyrion Lannister took them at their word. He was garbed in heavy quilted breeches and a woolen doublet, and over it all he had thrown the shadowskin cloak he had acquired in the Mountains of the Moon. The cloak was absurdly long, made for a man twice his height. When he was not a horse, the only way to wear the thing was to wrap it around him several times, which made him look like a ball of striped fur. Even so, he was glad he had listened. The chill in the long, dank vault went bone deep. Timmet had chosen to retreat back up to the cellar after a brief taste of the cold below. They were somewhere under the hill of Rainey's, behind the guildhall of the alchemists. The damp stone walls were splotchy with nitre, and the only light came from the sealed iron and glass oil lamp that Halin the pyromancer carried so gingerly.
Gingerly indeed, and these would be the ginger jars.
Tyrion lifted one for inspection. It was round and ruddy, a fat clay grapefruit. A little big for his hand, but it would fit comfortably in the grip of a normal man, he knew. The pottery was thin, so fragile, that even he had been warned not to squeeze too tightly, lest he crush it in his fist. The clay felt roughened, pebbled. Halin had told him that it was intentional.
A smooth pot is more apt to slip from a man's grasp.
The wildfire oozed slowly toward the lip of the jar when Tyrion tilted it to peer inside. The colour would be a murky green, he knew, but the poor light made that impossible to confirm.
Thick, he observed.
That is from the coal, my lord, said Halin, a pallid man with soft, damp hands and an obsequious manner.
He was dressed in striped black and scarlet robes trimmed with sable, but the fur looked more than a little patchy and moth-eaten.
As it warms, the substance will flow more easily, like lamp oil.
The substance was the pyromancer's own term for wildfire. They called each other wisdom as well, which Tyrion found almost as annoying as their custom of hinting at the vast secret stores of knowledge that they wanted him to think they possessed. Once theirs had been a powerful guild, but in recent centuries the maesters of the citadel had supplanted the alchemists almost everywhere. Now only a few of the older order remained, and they no longer even pretended to transmute metals. But they could make wildfire.
Water will not quench it, I am told. That is so. Once it takes fire, the substance will burn fiercely until it is no more. More, it will seep into cloth, wood, leather, even steel, so they take fire as well.
Tyrion remembered the Red Priest, Thoros of Myr, and his flaming sword. Even a thin coating of wildfire could burn for an hour. Thoros always needed a new sword after a melee, but Robert had been fond of the man and ever glad to provide one.
Why doesn't it seep into the clay as well?
Oh, but it does, said Halin. There is a vault below, this one, where we store the older pots. Those from King Eri's day, it was his fancy to have the jars made in the shapes of fruits. Very perilous fruits indeed, my lord Hand, and riper now than ever, if you take my meaning. We have sealed them with wax and pumped the lower vault full of water, but even so, by rights they ought to have been destroyed, but so many of our masters were murdered during the sack of King's Landing. The few acolytes who remained were unequal to the task, and much of the stock we made for Ares was lost. Only last year 200 jars were discovered in a storeroom beneath the great sept of Baelor. No one could recall how they came there, but I'm sure I do not need to tell you that the High Septon was beside himself with terror. I myself saw that they were safely moved. I had a cart filled with sand and sent our most able acolytes. We worked only by night. We did a splendid job, I have no doubt.
Tyrion placed the jar he had been holding back among its fellows. They covered the table, standing in orderly rows of four and marching away into the subterranean dimness. And there were other tables beyond, many other tables.
These are fruits of the late King Ares. Can they still be used? Oh, yes, most certainly. But carefully, my lord, ever so carefully. As it ages, the substance grows even more, fickle, let us say. Any flame will set it afire, any spark, too much heat, and jars will blaze up of their own accord. It is not wise to let them sit in sunlight, even for a short time.
Once the fire begins within, the heat causes the substance to expand violently and the jars shortly fly to pieces. If other jars should happen to be stored in the same vicinity, those go up as well. And so, how many jars do you have at present? This morning, the wisdom Munsiter told me that we had 7,840. That count includes 4,000 jars from King Ares' day, to be sure. Are over ripe fruits?
Halen bobbed his head.
Wisdom Meliard believes we shall be able to provide a full 10,000 jars, as was promised the Queen. I concur.
The pyromancer looked indecently pleased with that prospect. Assuming our enemies give you the time. The pyromancers kept their recipe for wildfire a closely guarded secret, but Tyrion knew that it was a lengthy, dangerous, and time-consuming process. He had assumed the promise of 10,000 jars was a wild boast, like the bannerman who vows to marshal 10,000 swords for his lord and shows up on the day of battle with 102.
If they can truly give us 10,000...
He did not know whether he ought to be delighted or terrified.
Perhaps a smidgen of both. I trust that your guild brothers are not engaging in any unseemly haste, Wisdom. We do not want 10,000 jars of defective wildfire, not even one. And we most certainly do not want any mishaps.
There will be no mishaps, my Lord Hand. The substance is prepared by trained acolytes in a series of bare stone cells, and each jar is removed by an apprentice and carried down here the instant it is ready. Above each work cell is a room filled entirely with sand. A protective spell has been laid on the floors most powerful. Any fire in the cell below causes the floors to fall away, and the sand smothers the blaze at once.
Not to mention the careless acolyte.
By spell, Tyrion imagined Halen meant clever trick. He thought he would like to inspect one of these false ceiling cells to see how it worked. But this was not the time. Perhaps when the war was won.
My brethren are never careless, Halen insisted. If I may be, frank?
Oh, do.
The substance flows through my veins and lives in the heart of every pyromancer. We respect its power. But the common soldier, the crew of one of the Queen's Spitfires, say, in an unthinking frenzy of battle, any little mistake can bring catastrophe. That cannot be said too often. My father often told King Ares as much as his father told old King Jaehaerys.
They must have listened, Tyrion said. If they had burned the city down, someone would have told me. So your counsel is that we had best be careful.
Be very careful, said Halen. Be very, very careful.
These clay jars... Do you have an ample supply?
We do, my lord, and thank you for asking.
You won't mind if I take some, then? A few thousand?
A few thousand?
Or however many your guild can spare, without interfering with production?
It's empty pots I'm asking for, understand?
Have them sent round to the captains on each of the city gates.
I will, my lord, but why...
Tyrion smiled up at him.
When you tell me to dress warmly, I dress warmly. When you tell me to be careful, well...
He gave a shrug.
I've seen enough. Perhaps you would be good enough to escort me back to my litter.
It would be my great, pleasure, my lord.
Halen lifted the lamp and led the way back to the stairs.
It was good of you to visit us, a great honour. It has been too long since the King's Hand graced us with his presence, not since Lord Rossart, and he was of our order. That was back in King Ares' day. King Ares took a great interest in our work.
King Ares used you to roast the flesh off his enemies. His brother Jamie had told him a few stories of the Mad King and his pet pyromancers. "Joffrey will be interested as well, I have no doubt. Which is why I'd best keep him well away from you."
"It is our great hope to have the King visit our guild hall in his own royal person. I have spoken of it to your royal sister. A great feast."
It was growing warmer as they climbed.
"His Grace has prohibited all feasting until such time as the war is won."
"At my insistence?"
"The king does not think it fitting to banquet on choice food while his people go without bread."
"A most loving gesture, my lord. Perhaps instead some few of us might call upon the king at the Red Keep. A small demonstration of our powers, as it were, to distract his grace from his many cares for an evening. Wildfire is but one of the dread secrets of our ancient order. Many and wondrous are the things we might show you."
"I will take it up with my sister." Tyrion had no objection to a few magic tricks, but Joff's fondness for making men fight to the death was trial enough. He had no intention of allowing the boy to taste the possibilities of burning them alive. When at last they reached the top of the steps, Tyrion shrugged out of his shadowskin fur and folded it over his arm. The guild hall of the alchemists was an imposing warren of black stone, but Halen led him through the twists and turns until they reached the gallery of the iron torches, a long, echoing chamber where the columns of green fire danced around black metal columns 20 feet tall. Ghostly flames shimmered off the polished black marble of the walls and floor, and bathed the hall in an emerald radiance. Tyrion would have been more impressed if he hadn't known that the great iron torches had only been lit this morning in honour of his visit, and would be extinguished the instant the doors closed behind him. Wildfire was too costly to squander. They emerged atop the broad, curving steps that fronted on the Street of the Sisters near the foot of Visenya's Hill. He bid Halen farewell and waddled down to where Timmit, son of Timmit, waited with an escort of burned men. Given his purpose today, it had seemed a singularly appropriate choice for his guard. Besides, their scars struck terror in the hearts of the city rabble. That was all to the good these days. Only 3 nights past, another mob had gathered at the gates of the Red Keep, chanting for food. Joff had unleashed a storm of arrows against them, slaying 4, and then shouted down that they had his leave to eat their dead, winning us still more friends. Tyrion was surprised to see Bronn standing beside the litter as well. "What are you doing here?"
"Delivering your messages," Bronn said. "Ironhand wants you urgently at the Gate of the Gods. He won't say why, and you've been summoned to Magor's too."
"Summoned?" Tyrion knew of only one person who would presume to use that word. "And what does Cersei want of me?"
Bronn shrugged. "The queen commands you to return to the castle at once, and attend her in her chambers. That stripling cousin of yours delivered the message. 4 heirs on his lip, and he thinks he's a man."
4 heirs and a knighthood. He's Sir Lancel now, never forget."
Tyrion knew that Sir Jaslyn would not send for him unless the matter was of some import.
"I best see what Bywater wants. Inform my sister that I will attend her on my return."
"She won't like that," Bronn warned.
"Good. The longer Cersei waits, the angrier she'll become, and angry makes her stupid. I much prefer anger and stupid to composed and cunning."
Tyrion tossed his folded cloak into the litter, and Timmit helped him up after it. The market square inside the Gate of the Gods, which in normal times would have been thronged with farmers selling vegetables, was near deserted when Tyrion crossed it. Sir Jaslyn met him at the gate, and raised his iron hand in brusque salute.
"My lord, your cousin Cleosfrey is here, come from Riverrun, under a peace banner with a letter from Robb Stark."
"Peace terms?"
"So he says."
"Sweet cousin, show me to him." The gold cloaks had confined Sir Cleos to a windowless guardroom in the gatehouse. He rose when they entered.
"Tyrion, you are most welcome sight."
"That's not something I hear often, cousin."
"Has Cersei come with you?"
"My sister is otherwise occupied. Is this Stark's letter?" He plucked it off the table. "Sir Jaslyn, you may leave us." Bywater bowed and departed.
"I was asked to bring the offer to the Queen Regent," Sir Cleos said as the door shut.
"I shall." Tyrion glanced over the map that Robb Stark had sent with his letter. "All in good time, cousin. Sit, rest. You look gaunt and haggard." He looked worse than that, in truth.
"Yes," Sir Cleos lowered himself onto a bench. "It is bad in the Riverlands, Tyrion, around the God's Eye and along the King's Road especially. The River Lords are burning their own crops to try and starve us, and your father's foragers are torching every village they take and putting the small folk to the sword."
"That was the way of war. The small folk were slaughtered, while the highborn were held for ransom."
"Remind me to thank the gods that I was born a Lannister."
Sir Cleos ran a hand through his thin brown hair.
"Even with a peace banner, we were attacked twice. Wolves in mail, hungry to savage anyone weaker than themselves. The gods alone know what side they started on, but they're on their own side now. Lost 3 men and twice as many wounded."
"What news of our foe?" Tyrion turned his attention back to Stark's terms.
"The boy does not want too much, only half the realm. The release of our captives, hostages, his father's sword, oh yes, and his sister's." "The boy sits idle at River Run," Sir Cleos said. "I think he fears to face your father in the field. His strength grows less each day. The River Lords have departed, each to defend his own lands."
"Is this what father intended?" Tyrion rolled up Stark's map. "These terms will never do."
"Will you at least consent to trade the Stark girls for Teon and Willem?"
Sir Cleos asked plaintively. Teon Frey was his younger brother, Tyrion recalled.
"No," he said gently, "but we'll propose our own exchange of captives. Let me consult with Cersei and the council. We shall send you back to River Run with our terms."
Clearly the prospect did not cheer him.
"My lord, I do not believe Robb Stark will yield easily. It is Lady Catelyn who wants this peace, not the boy."
"Lady Catelyn wants her daughters." Tyrion pushed himself down from the bench, letter and map in hand. "Sir Jaslyn will see that you have food and fire. You look in dire need of sleep, cousin. I will send for you when we know more." He found Sir Jaslyn on the ramparts, watching several hundred new recruits drilling in the field below. With so many seeking refuge in King's Landing, there was no lack of men willing to join the city watch for a full belly and a bed of straw in the barracks. But Tyrion had no illusions about how well these ragged defenders of theirs would fight if it came to battle.
"You did well to send for me," Tyrion said.
"I shall leave Sir Cleos in your hands. He is to have every hospitality. And his escort?" the commander wanted to know. "Give them food and clean garb, and find a maester to see to their hurts. They are not to set foot inside the city, is that understood?" It would never do to have the truth of conditions in King's Landing reach Robb Stark in River Run.
"Well understood, my lord."
"Oh, and one more thing. The alchemists will be sending a large supply of clay pots to each of the city gates. You're to use them to train the men who will work your spitfires. Fill the pots with green paint and have them drill at loading and firing. Any man who sputters should be replaced. When they have mustered the paint pots, substitute lamp oil and have them work at lighting the jars and firing them while aflame. Once they learn to do that without burning themselves, they may be ready for wildfire." Sir Jaslyn scratched his cheek with his iron hand. "Wise measures, though I have no love for that alchemist piss." "Nor I,
but I use what I'm given." Once back inside his litter, Tyrion Lannister drew the curtains and plumped a cushion under his elbow. Cersei would be displeased to learn that he had intercepted Stark's letter, but his father had sent him here to rule, not to please Cersei.
It seemed to him that Robb Stark had given them a golden chance. Let the boy wait at Riverrun, dreaming of an easy peace. Tyrion would reply with terms of his own, giving the king in the north just enough of what he wanted to keep him hopeful. Let Sir Cleos wear out his bony, fray rump, riding to and fro with offers and counters. All the while their cousin, Sir Stafford, would be training and arming the new host he'd raised at Casterly Rock. Once he was ready, he and Lord Tywin could smash the Tullys and Starks between them. Now if only Robert's brothers would be so accommodating. Glacial as his progress was, still Renly Baratheon crept north and east with his huge southern host, and scarcely a night passed that Tyrion did not dread being awakened with the news that Lord Stannis was sailing his fleet up the Blackwater Rush. "Well, it would seem I have a goodly stock of wildfire, but still—" The sound of some hubbub in the street intruded on his worries. Tyrion peered out cautiously between the curtains. They were passing through Cobbler Square, where a sizable crowd had gathered beneath the leather awnings to listen to the rantings of a prophet. A robe of undyed wool belted with a hempen rope marked him for one of the begging brothers. "Corruption!" the man shouted shrilly. "There is a warning! Behold the Father Scourge!" He pointed at the fuzzy red wound in the sky. From this vantage, the distant castle on Aegon's High Hill was directly behind him, with the comet hanging forebodingly over its towers. "A clever choice of stage," Tyrion reflected. "We have become swollen, bloated, foul, brother couples with sister in the bed of kings, and the fruit of their incest keepers in his palace to the piping of a twisted little monkey demon. Highborn ladies fornicate with fools and give birth to monsters. Even the High Septon has forgotten the gods he bathes in scented waters and grows fat on lark and lamprey while his people starve. Pride comes before prayer. Maggots rule our castles, and gold is all, but no more. The rotten summer is at an end, and the whoremonger king is brought low. When the boar did open him, a great stench rose to heaven, and a thousand snakes slid forth from his belly, hissing and biting." He jabbed his bony finger back at comet and castle. "There comes the harbinger. Cleanse yourselves. The gods cry out, lest ye be cleansed. Bathe in the wine of righteousness, or you will be bathed in fire. Fire! Fire!" other voices echoed, but the hoots of derision almost drowned them out. Tyrion took solace from that. He gave the command to continue, and the litter rocked like a ship on a rough sea as the burned men cleared a path.
"Twisted little monkey demon, indeed." The wretch did have a point about the High Septon, to be sure.
What was it that Moonboy had said of him the other day?
"A pious man who worships the seven so fervently that he eats a meal for each of them whenever he sits to table."
The memory of the fool's jape made Tyrion smile. He was pleased to reach the Red Keep without further incident. As he climbed the steps to his chambers, Tyrion felt a deal more hopeful than he had at dawn.
"Time, that is all I truly need. Time to piece it all together. Once the chain is done..."
He opened the door to his solar. Cersei turned away from the window, her skirts swirling around her slender hips. "How dare you ignore my summons?
Who admitted you to my tower?
Your tower? This is my son's royal castle."
"So they tell me."
Tyrion was not amused. Crawn would be even less so. His moon brothers had the guard today.
"I was about to come to you, as it happens."
"Were you?" He swung the door shut behind him. "You doubt me?" "Always. And with good reason." "Oh, I'm hurt." Tyrion waddled to the sideboard for a cup of wine. He knew no surer way to work up a thirst than talking with Cersei. "If I've given you offence, I would know how." "What a disgusting little worm you are. Marcella is my only daughter. Did you truly imagine that I would allow you to sell her like a bag of oats?"
"Marcella," he thought. "Well, that egg has hatched. Let's see what colour the chick is."
"Hardly a bag of oats. Marcella is a princess. Some would say this is what she was born for. Or did you plan to marry her to Tommen?" Her hand lashed out, knocking the wine cup from his hand to spill on the floor. "Brother or no, I should have your tongue out for that. I am Joffrey's regent, not you. And I say that Marcella will not be shipped off to this Dornishman the way I was shipped off to Robert Baratheon." Tyrion shook the wine off his fingers and sighed. "Why not? She'd be a deal safer in Dorne than she is here." "Are you utterly ignorant or simply perverse? You know as well as I that the Martells have no cause to love us." "The Martells have every cause to hate us. Nonetheless, I expect them to agree. Prince Doran's grievance against House Lannister goes back only a generation, but the Dornishmen have warred against Storm's End and Highgarden for 1,000 years, and Renly has taken Dorne's allegiance for granted. Marcella is 9, Tristan Martell 11. I have proposed they wed when she reaches her 14th year. Until such time, she would be an honoured guest at Sunspear, under Prince Doran's protection."
"A hostage," Cersei said, mouth tightening.
"An honoured guest," Tyrion insisted. "And I suspect Martell will treat Marcella more kindly than Joffrey has treated Sansa Stark. I had in mind to send Sir Aerys O'Cart with her. With a Knight of the King's Guard as her sworn shield, no one is like to forget who or what she is."
"Small good Sir Aerys will do her if Doran Martell decides that my daughter's death would wash out his sister's."
"Martell is too honourable to murder a 9-year-old girl, particularly one as sweet and innocent as Marcella. So long as he holds her, he can be reasonably certain that we'll keep faith on our side, and the terms are too rich to refuse. Marcella is the least part of it. I've also offered him his sister's killer, a council seat, some castles on the marches." "Too much!" Cersei paced away from him, restless as a lioness, skirts swirling. "You've offered too much, and without my authority or consent."
"This is the Prince of Dorne we are speaking of. If I'd offered less, he'd likely spit in my face."
"Too much," Cersei insisted, whirling back.
"What would you have offered him? That hole between your legs?"
Tyrion said, his own anger flaring. This time he saw the slap coming. His head snapped around with a crack.
"Sweet, sweet sister," he said. "I promise you that was the last time you will ever strike me."
His sister laughed. "Don't threaten me, little man. Do you think father's letter keeps you safe? A piece of paper. Eddard Stark had a piece of paper too, for all the good it did him."
"Eddard Stark did not have the city watch," Tyrion thought. "Nor my clansmen, nor the sellswords that Brunn has hired. I do."
Or so he hoped, trusting in Varys, in Sir Jaslyn Bywater, in Brunn. Lord Stark had probably had his delusions as well. Yet he said nothing. A wise man did not pour wildfire on a brazier. Instead, he poured a fresh cup of wine.
"How safe do you think Marcella will be if King's Landing falls? Renly and Stannis will mount her head beside yours."
And Cersei began to cry. Tyrion Lannister could not have been more astonished if Aegon the Conqueror himself had burst into the room riding on a dragon and juggling lemon pies. He had not seen his sister weep since they were children together at Castle Rock. Awkwardly, he took a step toward her. When your sister cries, you are supposed to comfort her, But this was Cersei. He reached a tentative hand for her shoulder. "Don't touch me," she said, wrenching away. It should not have hurt, yet it did, more than any slap. Red-faced, as angry as she was grief-stricken, Cersei struggled for breath. "Don't look at me. Not like this. Not you." Politely, Tyrion turned his back. "I did not mean to frighten you. I promise you, nothing will happen to Myrcella." "Liar," she said behind him. "I'm not a child to be soothed with empty promises. You tell me you would free Jaime too. Well, where is he?"
"In Riverrun, I should imagine, safe and under guard, until I find a way to free him."
Cersei sniffed. "I should have been born a man. I would have no need for any of you then. None of this would have been allowed to happen. How could Jaime let himself be captured by that boy? And father, I trusted in him, fool that I am. But where is he now that he's wanted? What is he doing?"
"Making war. From behind the walls of Harrenhal," she said scornfully. "A curious way of fighting. It looks suspiciously like hiding. Look again. What else would you call it? Father sits in one castle and Robb Stark sits in another, and no one does anything?"
"There is sitting, and there is sitting," Tyrion suggested. "Each one waits for the other to move, but the lion is still poised, his tail twitching, while the fawn is frozen by fear, boughs turned to jelly. No matter which way he bounds, the lion will have him, and he knows it."
"And you're quite certain that father is the lion?" Tyrion grinned.
"It's on all our banners."
She ignored the jest. "If it was father who had been taken captive, Jaime would not be sitting by idly, I promise you."
"Jaime would be battering his host to bloody bits against the walls of Riverrun, and the others take their chances. He never did have any patience, no more than you, sweet sister."
"Not all of us can be as bold as Jaime, but there are other ways to win wars. Harrenhal is strong and well situated."
"And King's Landing is not, as we both know perfectly well. While father plays lion and fawn with the Stark boy, Renly marches up the Rose Road. He could be at our gates any day now."
"The city will not fall in a day. From Harrenhal, it is a straight, swift march down the King's Road. Renly will scarce have unlimbered his siege engines before father takes him in the rear. His host will be the hammer, the city walls the anvil. It makes a lovely picture."
Cersei's green eyes bored into him, wary, yet hungry for the reassurance he was feeding her. "And if Robb Stark marches?"
"Harrenhal is close enough to the fords of the Trident so that Roose Bolton cannot bring the northern foot across to join with the young wolf's horse. Stark cannot march on King's Landing without taking Harrenhal first, and even with Bolton, he is not strong enough to do that."
Tyrion tried his most winning smile.
"Meanwhile, father lives off the fat of the riverlands, while our uncle Stafford gathers fresh levies at the rock."
Cersei regarded him suspiciously. "How could you know all this? Did father tell you his intentions when he sent you here?"
"No. I glanced at a map."
Her look turned to disdain. "You've conjured up every word of this in that grotesque head of yours, haven't you, imp?" Tyrion tisked.
"Sweet sister, I ask you, if we weren't winning, would the Starks have sued for peace?"
He drew out the letter that Sir Cleos Frey had brought.
"The young wolf has sent us terms, you see. Unacceptable terms, to be sure, but still a beginning. Would you care to see them?"
"Yes." That fast she was all queen again. "How do you come to have them? They should have come to me."
"What else is a hand for, if not to hand you things?"
Tyrion handed her the letter. His cheeks still throbbed, where Cersei's hand had left its mark.
"Let her flay half my face. It will be a small price to pay for a consent to the Dornish marriage. He would have that now. He could sense it.
And certain knowledge of an informer, too. Well, that was the plum in his pudding.
Bran. Dancer was draped in bardings of snowy white wool, emblazoned.